Für alle ein Fest. Zum Aldi-Tiefpreis. Diese Woche Funny Frisch Chips Frisch. 150 Gramm für nur 88 Cent. Oder Langnese Cremissimo. Ab 825 Milliliter für nur 1,49 Euro. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey, and joining me today is an old friend.
Indeed.
Returning from our days at GamePro with Role so Players long. Realm. It's been a long time. Please welcome back Richard in Japan.
Hi, everybody. I'm Richard from Kotaku.com, and me and Kat go way back, so we're ready to talk about RPGs.
Richard from Kotaku, how are you doing these days?
I'm doing quite well. Writing a lot about all the popular Japanese games. It's what I do.
So I brought you on the show because It seems that you've played 70 hours of Xenoblade Chronicles X. And when I had Elliot Gay on the show a few weeks ago to talk about kind of what was going on in Japan, it was like a few days before Xenoblade Chronicles X had come out. And I had checked it out, but I think I was under embargo to be able to talk about it. Anyway, so we're going to get some more complete thoughts. And then, you know, this is a good opportunity to also talk about Xenoblade Chronicles, the original, which you played like way back when, when it was just in Japanese.
Yep.
So we can also talk about that. So anyway, Xenoblade Chronicles X, it's been out for quite a while. You've played a whole bunch. Tell me, what are your initial thoughts?
My initial thoughts are actually not that positive.
Oh, no. Crap. Everything I feared is coming true.
I know. How do I put this? It's a slog. It is a slog. And, like, the fact that I'm 70 hours in and I'm past the halfway point in the story should tell you that. And that there's only 12 story missions in the whole game. So that's also a thing.
Only 12 story missions in the whole game, okay.
Yeah.
By the way, we're not going to spoil anything.
No, I'll just say, like, each of those is, like, about 20 minutes long, those story missions. And they're spaced a certain amount of levels apart. Like, they're usually about 5 levels apart, each story quest. So you have to go grind 5 levels before you can do the next one. And that takes a long time. Let's just put it that way. But I want to be clear. There, basically, the way it's set up is there's the story missions, and then there's what's called Kizuna quests, which means bond quests. And those also have little story chunks. They're basically little side stories about all the people in the crashed space colony where it all takes place, called New Los Angeles. And you meet these people, and you learn about their problems, and you help them out, and whatever. And you get little cutscenes for each of those. And there's a couple dozen of those quests. And all the remaining quests, of which there are dozens upon dozens, are your standard quest board quests. No real plot, just go out, kill something, whatever.
So it's almost kind of the opposite of Xenoblade Chronicles, the original, which was a much more guided experience. So what's kind of the bulk of the gameplay? Just going out and doing fetch quests?
Yeah. Pretty much. Like, don't get me wrong, they do try to mix it up. Sometimes it'll be, go out and kill this thing with really crappy weapon. I've had that quest a couple times. Or, go kill this boss monster that only spawns during a rainstorm. Things like that. But for the most part, yeah, it's go out, kill stuff, or go out, collect stuff, or something along those lines.
So Xenoblade Chronicles X is, it, even though it's a sequel to Xenoblade Chronicles, it's not set in the same universe.
Yeah.
And it, the art is very different. It's more, it's almost like they're wearing Mass Effect power suits and that sort of thing. And you're kind of turned loose in this giant world to fight monsters and do as you will. So have you spent a lot of time just exploring? Has there been a lot to explore?
Oh, yes. Like, that's definitely the best part of the game. Like, I find the battles to be a slog. I find the questing to be boring. The story is so thin that it's a little tough to get into. But the exploring, I've spent hours exploring. And every hour I've spent just going around the world. You can basically... the entire giant continent that you start on is three giant zones out of five, which is the whole game. And in these zones, they're split into little quadrants, and each quadrant has something special about it. Sometimes there's data points where you will basically find this point somewhere in the environment, put down a probe that then connects to the internet you're building on the planet, which you then subsidize to make money.
Wait a minute, you're basically a telecoms agent?
Yes, that's part of your job, absolutely.
You're working for Fantasy Comcast, laying down fantasy internet?
Oh, yep, no. you gotta put down the infrastructure, you know? And then you tax the hell out of the users. Like, that's actually literally how you make money in the game. Like, monsters don't drop anything. Monsters don't drop any... Well, they drop materials, but raw materials don't sell for much, and you'll use them for crafting. It's a much better use of your time and money. But, like, yeah, you find the data points, and then you install certain additions into the data points to collect money. And that's how you get paid. It's kind of like Final Fantasy VIII, where you were paid a salary over, you know, you'd just leave the game on for a certain amount of time and you'd make money. It's the exact same thing for Xenoblade, but it's based on your internet infrastructure that you have built across the planet.
So when you say that the exploration is easily your favorite part, so... In the sense of you're like walking across the world and say there are caves that you can just find or lots of interesting dungeons, or it's just fun to try and walk across a landscape. Like, in what sense is the exploration super fun?
It's a really beautiful planet. Okay. It's very beautiful and very alien. A lot of games have tried to create alien worlds, and the way they create an alien world is, oh, look, there's a weird tree, or, oh, that glows a little weird. But Xenoblade Chronicles, like, has rock formations that could not exist on Earth. And, you know, you'll have just these giant... Like, even the desert is beautiful. It's got, like, sand waterfalls in the distance and giant alien artifacts spreading across the horizon. And you can walk up to them, you know, no matter how far away they are. It's all very seamless and feels like a big, giant world. I put up a video yesterday or 2 days ago that was me running from one end of the continent to the other. And even in the straightest line I could make it, that took me 31 minutes.
Yeah, Jeremy was just lamenting, actually, that open world games, like he wrote an article about this for US Gamer. He was lamenting that open world games don't really have true exploration anymore. That... they're all very guided experiences with tons of little icons on their map, and he created a little header image that has just like 5 billion little like landmarks and things to do. And I think Witcher 3 was better than most games about that, but it sounds like Xenoblade Chronicles X is truly a free-form exploration experience.
That's really what they want you to do. They want you to grab some quests and just go out. And you can try to get the quests or not, or, like, try to accomplish them. But I really had a lot of fun, like, just going and seeing where I could go in the world. And, you know, some places are blocked off, and they're usually blocked off by big giant monster ready to eat your face until you're a certain level. But besides that, it's really a lot of fun to, like, look at the giant rock formations and stuff and be like, can I get up there? How do I get up there? And trying to figure out your way to jump up there. And the gravity on the planet is noticeably lower than Earth, so you're able to jump incredible distances. It's kind of like John Carter.
Nintendo was emphasizing that when I was doing the demo with them. Like, they handed me the gamepad and said, just explore and do things. And I was like, all right. And so I just started going through the story. Because that's what I do, right? Okay.
Right.
I can't help critical pathing RPGs. Even when I'm playing a big RPG that I have, like, so many options and things to do, like, I'll finish it in, like, like this big 70, 80 hour game in like the course of 30 hours, because I'm just like, yep, well, that's pretty cool. And if like I see something that's kind of in the distance that looks interesting, I'll wander off the critical path to go do it. But otherwise, like, I'm mostly content to play through the story, do some quests, level up my party, and if I find something particularly interesting, I'll go play it. That's just the way I do it. But it doesn't sound like the critical path is particularly rewarding in Xenoblade Chronicles X.
Absolutely not. But I will say they do reward your exploration. Because like I said, you can find like the internet points. You can find those. But every zone, and there's tons. There's got to be probably 100 or more of these little zones on the map. And each of them has some sort of an objective. Sometimes it's a data point. Sometimes it's kill a super strong monster in the area. But by accomplishing whatever the special thing to do in that area is, you unlock fast travel in that area.
Well,
so
how about that?
So that really rewards you for, you know, you just go out there and you explore, and then you go, oh, hey, there's a data point here. Now I have fast travel all the way there. And that's nice.
How does it compare to Xenoblade Chronicles the original in your mind?
I wasn't exactly the biggest fan of the first Xenoblade Chronicles, disclaimer there. But that's because of how it played.
Okay.
Both the Xenoblade and Xenoblade X have the MMORPG battle system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you auto attack, and then you press your shortcut buttons to do special attacks, and that's what you do. That's the game. I'm of the strange variety of people who, if I wanted to play an MMORPG, I'd play an MMORPG. And putting what I consider an inferior battle system into a single-player game, you know, as a battle system specifically designed for all the lag and latency that comes from an online game, it seems backwards and annoying to me. And everything slows down, especially in Xenoblade X, where you'll just go out there and you'll fight. You'll just go to a random encounter and spend 2-3 minutes on a random encounter, and you'll get nothing for experience points afterwards, and you just waste all that time. And I always feel like, you know, I'm not really doing anything in battle. I just walk in and I push the shortcut buttons, and eventually I win, you know, and that's it.
So you're not seeing a lot of death to the combat?
No. There are interesting things in the combat, like the fact that like, your party members will call out for you to do a certain attack, a certain kind of attack, a heal or a buff or a sword attack or a ranged attack or whatever. They'll call out for one of those. And then if you use one of those skills while they're calling out for you, it heals the whole group. And that's your main way of healing in the game. I think that's pretty cool. It makes it so you don't need a healer, a dedicated healer in your group at all times.
See, my recollection of Xenoblade Chronicles is that most of the death is the way that you combine attacks. There's not a lot of min-maxing to be done in terms of customizing your characters, so the gear does have a fair number of stats and everything. But it sounds like they built out the customization a fair bit.
Oh, God, yeah. Like, so there's so much to do on the back end.
Right, so what can you do now compared to Xenoblade Chronicles that you couldn't do before?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't played Xenoblade Chronicles in almost, 4 or 5 years now? So forgive my memory on this. So I'll just tell you what Xenoblade Chronicles X has, and you can tell me if it was in the original or not at this point. But basically, now whatever armor you buy and wear, you make that armor more popular, which allows the company to prosper and make even better armor than they would normally for cheaper prices for you. So you're kind of like advertising their gear, and that kind of gear that you get through advertising is just so cool looking. It's amazing, no matter which company you tend to support. So that's one thing. Another thing is a lot of armor can be customized. They have open slots. You can build, I don't remember what they're called, like orbs basically to put in those slots. There's the mech customization, all that good stuff. What else? You can, of course, make weapons and items and, lots of stuff. drops, everything drops something, and there's items scattered everywhere for you to pick up, and they're all useful in some way, crafting-wise.
Yeah. So the armor, the armor popularity thing was definitely not in Xenoblade Chronicles, mm-hmm. and it reminds me, I was thinking of The World Ends With You, actually.
No, yeah. How the fashions would change. And they did change somewhat based on what you were wearing.
But there are also classes in this one, right?
Yeah, there are. Your supporting party members are classes. You're basically allowed to choose any class and right. switch between them whenever you want, basically. But you have to get... Like, basically, you start with the base class, you get that base class to level 10, then you unlock the next level of classes, you do those, you get those to level 10, and then those split off into different trees, etc., etc., and eventually you level them all the way up. Each one of your skill classes has a specific weapon loadout, one melee weapon and one ranged weapon, that are unique to that class, basically. Or at least when you get up to the advanced classes, that's how it starts to work. So, like, one will have a knife and a machine gun, and another one will have a lightsaber and Gundam-style dragoons.
Yes.
And yes, I did play that class.
So wait, do you get to drive around a giant mech?
You do, but it is a pain in the ass to get.
Really?
You get it after the sixth chapter. Literally halfway through the game, you get this thing where it's like, hey, do you want a mech? Well, good for you. I've got 8 fetch quests you need to do to get licensed.
Wow. How intense are the fetch quests?
At that point, I just grabbed the walkthrough, because I was just like, I'm not going to be bothered anymore by this. But even with that, it still took a while, because it's the gambit of quests. Like, if you were actually just going by what the game says, it's like, oh, yes, you need a specific flower that blooms only by this, only on this side of the desert. Like, and you're like, the desert's a big place. It's like a third of the game. Where? You know, and so I had to look up exactly where to go. It's very monotonous, but I think it maybe took me 2 hours when I knew what I was doing. And then after that, you get your first mech, which I promptly destroyed and couldn't figure out how to replace. That was fun.
How did you destroy it? Just like in a boss battle?
No, it's even stupider. I actually did a post on this on Kotaku, along with accompanying animated GIF for people who are interested in seeing my stupidity firsthand.
Kotaku does love their animated GIFs.
I do. I make them a lot. I abuse the hell out of them. But basically, there was a data point, an internet access point, in the middle of this canyon, on like bottomless canyon on an island. And I was like, now that I have this mech with jump jets that transforms into a motorcycle, surely I can make the jump to the data point. Spoiler warning, I didn't make the jump. And then I wasn't even close.
And then you couldn't figure out how to replace your
mech. No, and then I load back, and I'm like, oh, where's my mech? And I'm like, and I see this little, like, X over the mech symbol. I'm like, what the hell does that mean? Where do I even go? Like, there's one thing about Xenoblade Chronicles X is it doesn't really hold your hand at all. It's just kind of like, oh, you lost your mech. Guess you better figure out how to fix that. So I wandered around a lot until I finally found a menu in one of the buildings, because they're not all together, that was like, oh yeah, we can repair it. You have insurance, but if you destroy your thing 2 more times, your mech's gone forever. Bye. I'm like, oh.
Wow.
Well, die in a fire. Thank you. And by gone forever, I mean it's broken. It's completely broken. They can't fix it. So you have to go and buy a new mech.
Man, that's punitive.
Yeah, so, like, having your mech get destroyed is a horrible experience. And now, normally, what you can do is when it's destroyed, you have, like, the chance to eject. It's a quick time event. And if you do it perfectly, I don't think your mech gets destroyed. But the thing is, when you fall into a giant cliff, there is no quick time event. It's just gone. And so I felt dumb, really dumb. And I think it's later on, I think in maybe chapter 9 or 10, I think... is after that you get the flight license class, so your mech can actually fly. But I haven't done that one yet.
Is it like Macross style? You're turning into a jet?
I don't think so. I think you're still a motorcycle.
Still a motorcycle, but...
I think your jump jets just actually let you fly.
So, like, looking at the mech on the cover of the game, and that definitely doesn't look like a motorcycle.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Transforms into a motorcycle. Absolutely.
Transforms into a motorcycle. A really big motorcycle.
Yeah. Okay, it's like Robotech the movie. There you go. It's exactly like that mecha. So, Megazone 23 for all you other people.
Thank you, Richard. So, the picture that I'm getting is of a really kind of free-form exploration game with, like, things that you're just trying to get to, which pretty much jives with what I saw when I was playing it with Nintendo. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting that that's the direction that the guy who made Xenogears is taking the series, given that those games are mostly known for their really kind of over-the-top stories. It seems like he's moved away from that more and more and more to
more about
something
the
completely
world.
Different. Yeah. How do you feel about that change?
I'm one of the people who puts great value in plots of games, which is why I love RPGs so much, because they're usually all about the plot. And this one is pretty much, instead of a plot, it's a setting. It's you know, Earth decimated, space colonies sent out while Earth is destroyed, kind of in a crossfire. It's not like they were trying to destroy Earth. It was just we were in the wrong place in the wrong time, and two alien forces were just duking it out around Earth, and so there goes the planet. And you might be the last space colony of all humans. You don't know. But you crash land on this alien planet while being pursued by one of the alien forces, and now humanity's got to make a go of it. Like, that's the plot of the game. Is you've got to try to make friends with who you can and explore this new world, because that's where you're stuck and this is your new home.
Sounds
and so
like
it's a setting,
plot.
Right?
Sounds a lot like the plot to the original Xenogears. In the you remember that opening cutscene?
Yeah.
That was one of the best opening cutscenes that I've ever seen in a game. Because you have no idea what's going on. There's a spaceship. It's, like, under attack. Like, everybody's ejecting. Mm-hmm. And then they end up on a planet. You see one woman on a planet, I think. And then you only later find out that that happened thousands upon thousands of years before. And they repopulated the world. So humans came from space. So Xenoblade Chronicles X is almost kind of the prologue to Xenogears, so it's probably
maybe
a different
it could be. It very well
he likes
could
to
be.
Revisit those themes quite a bit.
And this one, like, I'll say this: the plot does have some twists, which is very nice.
What a twist!
Yeah, there was actually one that is very much legitimately. Oh, well, that changes everything. Kind of twist. So it was good that exists. I'm not saying the plot is just, you know, a straight run through, you know, run down the numbers or whatever. It does have some interesting points in it. It's just not much of a plot. It's go out, explore, help the city.
Yeah. And that's in part because you're creating your own characters, right? You create your own character in this.
You create your own character, but the rest of them are set. Another thing I don't particularly like in my RPGs.
I like creating the main character.
Do you? Well, yeah. I don't mean like a shepherd. Like, a shepherd is one thing, but having yourself be the faceless person with no backstory just thrown into the world.
Yeah, I'm pretty okay
like
with that, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I recorded a... actually, you know, I just recorded an interview with Brad Muir, who did Massive Chalice. And we talked a little bit about this, but I like being able to kind of create narratives in my own head. I like being given a canvas and just being allowed to imagine everything. So when the game explicitly lays everything out, there's a certain remove to it that I've increasingly found less enticing.
Interesting.
Which, now in the case of a really terrific story-based game like, say, Persona, I get super invested in it anyway. And even though I didn't relate at all to the main character, who was some high schooler, a guy, I still I was able to engage with that group of people because I really liked them. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, I like to have things kind of left to the imagination. What do you think of the art?
Like in the game?
In the game of Xenoblade Chronicles X.
I think, other than the character designs, which are kind of atrocious, I really love the art design of the planet, of the mechs, of the armor. I love all of it.
The armor is super sweet. It's like Mass Effect.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It goes so far beyond. I went with like some more like what we'll call mage-style armor, and it grows like horns, like demon horns on it, and spikes off the armor, that kind of stuff. But there's also another set of armor, which becomes more and more like utilitarian, like army style, like in Mass Effect. There's that set of armor as well. And then there's stuff that's more like... what do you call it? A cowboy poncho, you know, from like a Western. There's a whole set of costume or of armor that's kind of like that, like a gunslinger attire. That's really cool, too.
Done and done. Gunslinger poncho right here. Did you ever play Phantasy Star Online?
Phantasy Star Online? No, I played the second one.
You played the second one? Okay, how does it compare to that?
They're both kind of sci-fi fantasy style things, but Phantasy Star Online 2 is, it never makes you feel like you're in a big world, a big open world. It's more like you're in a randomly generated set of corridors that have been assembled into a dungeon-like layout, and you and your team go and do whatever. Xenoblade Chronicles X is chucking you into a world.
I was only thinking of Phantasy Star Online because... Hmm. Xenoblade Chronicles X feels very much like a offline MMORPG in my mind.
It does. It is. Although there are interesting online counterparts. Like there is multiplayer stuff you can do in the game, although I haven't really played around with it too much, but
except it's lacking the things that I like about MMORPGs, which is, you know, partying up and doing these really involved like raids and everything.
Yes.
So it's more like what people kind of imagine that they would want to do in an MMORPG, which is wander around the world and see what they can find, which people do. And that's pretty cool. It's interesting what you're telling me.
Have I broken your heart or have I made you excited?
I don't know. I guess I will have to see how I feel about it when I actually play it. I'm not normally given to be the kind of person to just wander around and explore, so it'll be kind of a different paradigm for sure. I am a little bit higher on the battle system of Xenoblade than you are, and it's pretty similar to the original Xenoblade Chronicles.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just because I liked the way that the characters interacted. I liked the build-up and release of like large your kind of your superpowers. I liked the diversity of the boss battles. How are the boss battles, by the way, in Xenoblade Chronicles X?
Pretty much the same as the other battles, only everything has more HP.
Everything has more HP. Okay,
yeah, so that's pretty much it.
That's the fun part about Xenoblade Chronicles the original, was that, you know, you really had to put some thought into your class or to your party composition, because if you just went in, say, with Shulk, and you tried to kill a... if you tried to kill an organic person with Monado, you would do no damage, essentially.
Right, right.
So you had to, like, move things around, and as you got more and more party members, your tactical options got more and more diverse. So certain bosses were really given toward... certain party combinations. So,
well, let's see. In this, in Xenoblade Chronicles X, there's basically three elemental types. There's like normal bullets, ether, and of course I'd forget the third one. But it's basically three different types of weapons, like kind of a laser, a bullet, or this kind of thing in between, and certain bosses are weak to one element and strong to another, but you can always go and buy a weapon of similar power that is of, you know, the element that the enemy is weak to. The other thing that's kind of interesting is there's always multiple attack points on every enemy. And sometimes if you hit like an armored leg, you're going to do a lot less damage than you hit it than if you hit it in the soft underbelly. So it's kind of important to lock on to whatever their weakest point is whenever you're attacking.
Oh yeah. I remember now that I was thinking about Valkyrie Profile Somaria when I was playing that game, which for all its faults had an interesting battle system. Did you ever play Somaria?
No, I never did.
In Somaria, you would run in a kind of 3D environment, and then the game would flip to 2D, and when you were attacking, like, so you wanted to align yourself with the enemy in such a way that you could attack certain body parts, because if you could break off those body parts, you would get, that was how you got all of your items for crafting and that kind of thing.
I think actually it's somewhat similar then. Okay. Because you do get certain special items if, like, you're fighting a giant scorpion, let's say, and you attack the stalk of the tail and break it off mid-battle, for example. I do believe you get special items from that.
So I assume that you didn't end up playing the 3DS version of Xenoblade Chronicles?
Did not, no.
Just took a pass on it?
Took a straight-up pass. It was a game that I enjoyed for the plot, but... the battle system, I mean, it's the same reason I don't particularly like Final Fantasy XII. I just felt like the battle system is not something I wanted to deal with.
I don't know.
I just like it faster. I like my battle system much faster.
Right. Even you like the Tales games.
The Tales games, I like it because they're involved. Like, the combat's really involved. I like traditional turn-based because, you know, it's good and quick.
I like a good turn-based RPG, but... I feel like Xenoblade Chronicles is a suitable, I should say, compromise between the two. It's not completely real time, but it has enough of the tactical depth of a turn-based game that I don't hate it too much. It's only when it starts getting like hack hack slash slash and that's all I'm doing, a la Kingdom Hearts, that I start getting really bored. So we're a differing opinions on the on the combat system in Xenoblade Chronicles,
which is good enough. I'm glad many people enjoy it. Like, don't get me wrong, just because I don't particularly enjoy it doesn't mean that
it's divisive, you know, actually. I've heard people say that it's not nearly deep enough. I've heard a lot of people say that they really like it. I know that Jeremy was not a fan of the Xenoblade Chronicles combat system when we reviewed it together for the Nintendo 3DS. Unfortunately, never really got a chance to get around to talking about Xenoblade Chronicles on this podcast, and I almost feel like I never really will. And it's not because I'm a hater or whatever. It's just that Jeremy was unavailable at the like key point when I was supposed to talk about it, and then when I was like, "Do you want to come on the show and talk about it?" He was like, "I don't really have a lot to say about that game." He didn't like that game, so. It was okay. I was surprised because it had gotten so much hype. And then when I finally played it, I was like, oh, okay.
It was one of those times where when Operation Rainfall was going on, and I actually played all three games involved with Operation Rainfall, the one I really liked was The Last Story.
Last Story was really creative.
Yeah, that was a gem of an RPG. And this one, Xenoblade Chronicles, wasn't bad. It was just not my cup of tea, exactly.
I'd say it was above average.
Yeah.
I'm glad that it exists.
Oh, absolutely.
If I had been reviewing it just on the Wii, I probably would have given it, like, 4 out of 5. Just because I loved the scope. I loved the expansiveness of the experience. I liked the combat for the most part. As I was saying, because I like the mixing and matching of the party, which is catnip for me. I think the story's fine. I think that Xenoblade Chronicles would have been right in that, just above Rogue Galaxy territory on the PS2. Like, it would have fit right into that kind of PC milieu, or PS2 milieu. Mm-hmm. That was coming out between like 2003, 2005. Mm-hmm. Definitely mm-hmm. better than Grandia 3, which was a real disappointment, though I did like its battle system. one instance in which the story really dragged down the game for me was Grandia 3. But, yeah, no, it was fine. It was really hurt by the transition to 3DS, in my opinion.
That's pretty much our conclusion over at Kotaku as well, I noticed.
Yeah, like, it was just... It was so technically hurt. It was so much more, so much less attractive that a lot of the scope got lost in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the UI wasn't great. And it feels like they put everything into just making sure that that game got running at a stable frame rate on the 3DS, which even with the
new 3DS too.
The new 3DS must have been a chore. Which they did. And, you know, people who are really into a good JRPG will be like, all right, sweet. I got Xenoblade Chronicles on my 3DS, and this is a great media experience. But if somebody came to me and said, recommend me an RPG, I don't know. I'd probably recommend Xenoblade Chronicles. I don't know.
But you'd like, say, do it thinking, on the Wii?
No, I was just thinking, like, if somebody asked me to recommend them a 3DS RPG,
Fire Emblem?
Fire Emblem Awakening for sure, yeah. Yeah, I love that one. But that's a strategy RPG. I guess Bravely Default is kind of is kind of the choice, but that one didn't really do anything for me either. God, I'm such a contrarian. Why am I a hater? It makes me sad. Well, because everybody loves Bravely Default.
I enjoyed it. I liked the throwback nature, but I didn't think it was the end-all be-all.
The sequel's not out, right?
Actually, it is out in Japan, but I have not picked it up personally.
What? Come on, yeah. Richard. You're Richard from Japan. Get on that stuff.
So many games, so little time.
Gosh, so much to keep track of. All right, so is there anything you're looking forward to coming out for the rest of the year?
RPG-wise? That's a good question.
Or I should say Japanese RPG-wise.
Japanese RPG.
You are Richard from Japan.
Indeed. Off the top of my head, not particularly.
What? You're not looking forward to Persona 5?
Is that confirmed for this year?
I'm pretty sure it's coming out this year.
If it is coming out this year, then absolutely. I guess the...
I swear, it said 2015. They haven't done a...
That's true.
Like, I felt like it's kind of all but assumed that it's coming out this year.
Of course, I'd pick that up.
I almost guarantee it'll be December.
The new Fire Emblem. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, new Fire Emblem. We'll have to have you on the show to talk about that one, too.
Yeah, but other than that, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head if there's any other really big ones coming.
The SMT Cross Fire Emblem.
Oh yeah, that's true. That's coming too.
That'll be interesting. I've already mentioned this on the show. I'm really enjoying Persona Q.
Oh, are you?
So any opportunity to get back into that universe is welcome to me. And it's Fire Emblem and Shin Megami Tensei, that's like mashing up two of my favorite things. It's going to be great.
Make sure you're really, really happy.
Yes.
And then 15's always looming on the horizon.
You didn't play, you know, Hyperdimension Neptunia and the Vita's coming out.
Oh, that's true. I didn't play any of the Vita versions of the game, except for the strategy RPG one, the Noir game. And I actually really liked that one. I thought that one was a lot of fun.
Really?
I'm not one for strategy games usually, strategy RPGs, other than Valkyria Chronicles anyway. And
Fire Emblem?
There's my dirty little secret. I have never played a Fire Emblem.
What? You didn't play Fire Emblem Awakening? God.
I didn't play any of them.
One horrifying revelation after another, Richard.
I know, scary, right?
So you gotta play Awakening.
No, that's what
people
say. Stop
talking right now, go get your 3DS and start downloading it. I insist. That's the best game on the damn 3DS, Richard.
Okay, well, geez, that's an opinion right there. That's something I'm going to have to take to heart.
I'm sticking to it. That is my hot take. Like, I'm looking at my I'm thinking about my 3DS right now. Like, I'm picturing it in my head. And I'm like, nope, can't think of a better game than Fire Emblem Awakening on that thing. I can't think of a game that I enjoyed more than that. So, great game.
Well, there you go. Wow. It, pulling out all the stops with recommendations.
Welcome back. Joining me now is Double Fine's Brad Muir, who created Massive Chalice, a new RPG strategy game that was recently released on Steam. And Brad, before we get started, I just want to pour one out for two dear departed party members of mine, Kale Chesthair Blackbane and Tancred Flamingo Blackbane, two brothers...
Oh my god, I love that they got, like those are some of the most ridiculous nicknames in the entire game that you could have pulled. Flamingo and Chest Hair. Like, some of them are standard. Like, there are a lot of, like, you know, tough animal names and stuff, and they're, like, boar or whatever, you know? But then there's Flamingo as well.
Well, Flamingo is fancy. Yeah, he has blonde hair. He looks fancy.
All right. He looked fancy, right?
And his younger brother... Kale, like, went for the bald look, and he's got a big gray beard, a great big bushy beard.
Very few people choose to go for the bald look, you know. I think that's that's genetic, sort of playing you a bad hand.
Do you think they gave each other those nicknames?
I could totally see that. Yeah, so actually, that's really awesome that you say that. Like, I love how people get attached to their characters, even though they're pretty fleeting in the game. I like seeing players, like, get attached to them and then start, like, manufacturing additional narrative on top of, like, what's there. Because in terms of your heroes, there's very little sort of narrative in the game outside of, like, the random events. And those aren't guaranteed to actually happen to, like, all of your characters and stuff. So, yeah, I like that people make up stuff like that, you know, thinking about them. Like, yeah, giving each other nicknames and giving each other shit on the battlefield. Like, yeah, naming your brother Flamingo is pretty good, especially when it sticks.
So, let's talk a little bit about the game itself. So, it's a, as I already said, an RPG strategy game with kind of strong XCOM undercurrents. Mm-hmm. We did a game dev recipes about this game a while ago. You said it was 40% XCOM, 20% Final Fantasy Tactics, a little bit of Fire Emblem mixed in there with some FTL and Valkyria Chronicles. These are all, like, great things to have into one game. So tell me a little bit about how all of this kind of came together.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've always been a huge fan of the original XCOM. And it's kind of a bummer that up until the reboot, I felt like they had not really done that thing justice. You know, like, it was... Terror from the Deep was sort of just like a reskinning of it, and then there was, like, God, was it called Apocalypse? The third one?
That wasn't there. There's a first person shooter.
And then there was a first person shooter, and there was Enforcer. There were just, I don't know, some very not the best uses of that license or that franchise. But the original one is the one that, like, really stuck in my mind. I played a ton of it, played through it several times. Like, oh God, I'm going to date myself. I was probably in high school playing that game. Totally loved it, and I've been surprised that nobody's really done any kind of, like, riffs on that structure. You know, the real feeling of, like, having a strategic kind of meta layer where you're managing a bunch of really, like, high level things, and then a very, like, human scale tactical layer where you're controlling, like, individual people. So you have something like Civilization where, you know, you're it's all about the meta layer and you're controlling, like, armies and stuff. You never really feel like you're getting to know individual characters. And then on the flip side, you have things like Final Fantasy Tactics where it's, like, all about the human scale and you're controlling individual characters. But I really like the sense of, like, kind of fusing those things together that XCOM brought to the table, where you're, like, you're kind of defending the entire world, but then you're also doing it with a squad of, like, only a dozen characters at a time or whatever. I have always really liked that, and I feel like not enough strategy games have tried to build on what they started. Like, you know, how long ago was that? Like 20 plus years ago or something? It's crazy.
Well, the original XCOM came out in, what, the early 90s?
Oh, God, so. Yes, yeah. Oh, man, that's making me feel old. But yeah, I've had the idea for a long time to, at least it kind of started as, like, let's just, you know, why isn't there a fantasy XCOM? Just, I mean, that's, you know, with more RPG stuff in it. Like, it seemed like a slam dunk, and I was sort of surprised that nobody had really taken on that challenge, you know? But I always, I don't know, I hate just sort of, like, taking, you know, like it's not a clone, right? Like, if you take an existing game design and you completely change the thematics, you're gonna have some like mechanical things that sort of flop out of it that are quite different, right? In this case, like you have XCOM, which is like all futuristic and sci-fi, and you have all ranged weapons. So just by the nature of saying like let's make a fantasy XCOM, you do have a lot of mechanical things that fall out of that. You're probably going to have a lot of melee combat, and that's going to change things. And, you know, do you have cover? Do you need cover anymore? Like, because not everybody is a ranged character. It's like there's a lot of stuff that like falls out of it, which is cool. But I really wanted to have a hook that was unique to our game, and that didn't, you know, so it wasn't just sort of like a carbon copy of like the XCOM, sort of the overall XCOM design. And for that, like it took a while to sort of like find something that I really liked, but the kind of core, like the design pillar was that I wanted your party to get mixed up all the time, right? Like I think a lot of people that play Final Fantasy Tactics or Fire Emblem or XCOM, like they tend to just use the same characters every time. Like for every battle, they're just using the same characters. And even though those games have permadeath, I think that usually when one of your characters dies to either like, you know, bad RNG or like a mistake that you made, they'll like reload. They'll reload the game. Like people don't want to suffer those. People don't want to suffer a death of one of their favorite characters, so they'll just reload and they never have to deal with it. And I think that they're really missing out on like a good, like a really good opportunity that the game is presenting you. Like if you screw up and one of your key characters dies, trying to continue without them and train up a new character and sort of fill that slot in your party is like a great opportunity to play the game in a slightly different way. And I think that, yeah, I think a lot of people that do reload, they don't actually get to enjoy that part of those games, you know? So just that core thing of like, how can we kill your characters basically was like, you know, that sort of began the search for the hook for the game. Was like, how can I mix up your party by like just removing or deleting characters that you're relying on and force you to rely on other characters? And then that sort of forces your party to be constantly rotating. And the best way that I could come up with was that just like, you know, what if they age and die? Like, you know, it's just that simple. It's like something that's very easy to grasp. The timeline of XCOM, like when you're on the Geoscape and you hit play, it's like hours are passing really fast as like the sun spins around the globe and stuff. And so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a huge leap to just be like, oh, well, what if that was like, you know, days instead of hours? Like then that would stretch into years and then all of your characters would age and then a bunch of them would pass away. And then that would just really in a very like natural way, it would force you to engage with the permadeath system. So yeah, I think that just starting with that and being like, is this, you know, would this work? Is this a cool hook? Just kind of batting around the office and talking to people about it, you know, immediately all of these other systems kind of come out of it, like marriage and babies and, you know, what's the age of, you know, like what, how old does somebody have to be before they can go to battle? And then like, do you allow, like, yeah, do you have menopause in the game? Like, there are all these, like, weird questions that start, like, flying out of it. And, like, right away I knew that, like, it was probably good enough to base the entire game off of it as, like, one of the... Yeah, I use the word pillars. That's, like, such a dirty term, I think. Because that's used... like, I used to pitch to publishers a lot. And they always want to know what your pillars are. It's basically just, like, the foundations of your game. Like, what are the most important things in your game? And like, yeah, the timeline and the aging characters are like some of the most important things in Master Chalice, because it really brings you back to that sort of core design thing of a constantly evolving tactical party.
It was, my own experience has been that at first it really threw me off, mm-hmm. because these characters were coming and going so fast, and I would set up, you know, a couple regions, and then characters just kept popping up. And every time I went into battle, it felt like I had a whole new group. And so they felt like cannon fodder, less like people and more like cannon fodder. And the reason that I brought up Old Chest Hair and Flamingo was that they were the first kind of instance where I felt like I was able to attach myself to these characters because they kept popping up over and over again. They didn't die.
Right.
And I wasn't restarting, you know. They just kept coming back over and over again.
Because they're living, you know, it's like you probably, you know, just a lot of it is through circumstance that you end up deploying a rather young character that's like in their teens. And then they do pretty well and they live and they gain some experience. And then they're going to be one of your better characters in the next battle and the next and the next and the next. And, you know, before you know it, you know, you've gone through, you've been playing for like a couple hours. And that, you know, Chest Hair is like, has been in, you know, five of those tactical battles in a row, except now, you know, he's bald with a huge beard. But yeah, I think that's cool. I think that's cool that not all characters are memorable, right? It's like, it really lets them sort of stick out in your mind. Another thing that we really wanted to do was get you not necessarily attached to the characters, or just only attached to the characters, but also attached to their bloodline, like attached to their house. So all the characters have like a sigil that is part of their house. It's kind of like directly inspired by like the Game of Thrones houses, and like they have mottos and stuff like that. And they all have like iconic like two color pairs. And so you kind of get used to, what was their last name? Did you say
Blackbane?
Blackbane. So you see the Blackbane flag. You see like their sigil and, you know, their colors. And so all the people that are of that bloodline, they all have like the same sigil and the same colors. And you sort of always want to have Blackbanes like in your party, and you want to make sure that like their bloodline continues as you play through the game and stuff. So it's like you're attached not only to like Flamingo and Chest Hair, but like also the Blackbane bloodline. You know, it's like I kind of wanted it to be a 50-50 mix where you're attached to characters, but you're also attached to these bloodlines, so that you're sort of caring about two things. It also lets you care about you're caring more about the individuals on the tactical layer, and then you're caring, and then the flip side on the strategy layer, you're caring more about the bloodlines on the strategy layer.
The Blackbanes are my main family. They're everywhere. They're always in my party.
Yeah, it's cool. It's probably the very first family that you established as you were.
I think they were. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they have the deepest roots.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing that jumped out at me was, at the outset, it feels like you only have three classes. So you got your Caberchak, he's like a battering ram, right?
Yep.
That
was like a, I'm most proud of that in terms of the three classes, the Caberchak. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like our melee, you know, kind of standard, typical melee tank class, like heavily armored. But in terms of the weapon, like we didn't want to just have like a sword and board or like, you know, a two-handed weapon that was sort of something that you'd seen before. I spent a lot of time trying to find something that would be, you know, just be more unique. And I've always loved those battering rams that the SWAT teams use. Our art director, Andy Wood, he's English, and they call that thing the master key in England. So yeah, you know, it's just like a kind of a two-handed thing that you hold that's like just a big, super solid, like dense piece of metal. And they swing it and just like knock open doors with it. And you know, looking at that thing for inspiration, it's like, why couldn't we use this as like a cool medieval weapon? And it also led us in a direction where the character's more about like stuns, because it's like a blunt weapon, like more about stuns and knockbacks, like pushing characters around. And I think that felt really natural with that kind of a weapon. I think it also looks really cool. It looks just very different, and you, the kind of stance for the character is very different from something that you would see in a typical fantasy game as well. I mean, it's not only cool looking, but it also, helps the silhouette of the character. Because that weapon is like very kind of like underslung and they hold it sort of low, it really helps you differentiate like what the characters are. Sorry, I keep going off on tangents, Kat. I don't know.
No, it's sort okay. Of my. That's the point of a podcast.
Yeah, right.
On tangents.
Just run around and talk about whatever.
Next, we can talk about Game of Thrones. So the other two classes are kind of the crossbow person, but it's like a giant mechanical crossbow, yep. and then also the alchemist. First of all, the one thing that strikes me is that they're really non-traditional.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, how did you settle on like those three kind of archetypes, and what kept you from like expanding outward and adding in like sword carriers and
sure.
and other types of classes to kind of like flesh out the range?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we kind of, you know, we were just looking at like mechanical archetypes for the tactical side. So just having like a heavy melee character like made a lot of sense. So that's where the Caberjack came from. And then wanting to have a range character, that's where the Hunter sort of fits, single target range character. And with that, our sort of twist on it is that it's almost like an RPG. It's like a big giant shoulder mounted crossbow that they use. And then the having like I didn't want to have traditional magic in the game. All of the sort of like magic things in the game come from the enemies, come from the Cadence. It's like you sort of like research how they operate and what sort of, you know, we never really explain it, but like what sort of energy they use and use parts of their corpses and whatever to fashion some new weapons that have a little bit more like magical abilities, I would say. But yeah, I really wanted to stay away from magic as much as possible, mainly because I just think that, you know, most fantasy games just kind of throw a wizard in there and then you've got fireballs and magic missiles and a lot of the more tropesy stuff. So just from trying to stay away from like, you know, tropesy kind of fantasy things, and stay away from some of the high fantasy stuff as well. We just decided that was kind of like a hard and fast rule for us, that we didn't want to have like traditional magic on the side, mainly because I thought it would muddy the waters between like I wanted the enemy kind of like that Mega Man feeling of like stealing the enemy's technology and using it against them. Like if we were going to have that as the primary magic thing, I think that if you have that along with kind of more traditional fireballs and magic missiles, it just gets a little muddy. But yeah, so the alchemist was sort of our placeholder or replacement for a more like magic user type class. So they're more of a like melee character that fights with this big kind of giant hook, but they can use the hook like sort of like a highlight. That was the inspiration for that thrower thing. It's sort of like a highlight glove. I don't know what they call it. Damn. Oh, no, wait. I know what they call it. It's called a Zystra. It starts with an X.
Are you a former highlight player?
No, I had to look that up. I had no idea what it was called. But highlight is like that super weird sport where you have this like big sort of... I don't know what it's made out of. It's like a woven kind of hook sling thing. And they fling this really hard ball against, I think it's kind of like racquetball. You like fling this really hard ball against the wall, and I don't know. I guess they can fling it really, really fast, and some people die playing High Life. It's super dangerous.
But, I know about High Life because of Mad Men.
I did not. I gave up on Mad Men. Oh, I'm so bad. I'm like outing myself.
Jeez, Brad.
I know. You know what? It was depressing me way too much. I was getting like about, I think I made it about halfway, and it was just, I was getting too depressed at the end of every episode because everybody's pretending to be something they're not, and they're all super unhappy, and it's like so sad, and I was like, I can't deal with this.
There's an episode where somebody's coming in and pitching a highlight league, so that's where I heard about it for
yeah.
the first time.
Oh, it's a really weird sport, but yeah. So the alchemist, so they fight with this thing. It's sort of like got blades on it, and they're like a melee class, but they can also fling these explosive potions, which gives us some like medium range AOE in there. So yeah, it's like you primarily have your melee class, your range, your single target range class, and then your medium range AOE class. And then those are kind of like the, you know, we didn't really want to have a healer. That was another, like, I think if we were to add a fourth class, it would probably be like a healer. But I always try to stay away from the kind of MMO trinity if I can, like in my designs, just because I feel like, I don't know. I feel like it's kind of stale and it's very rote and it gets like, it just feels a little bit played out, I would say. Where you have those just like super hard rolls, and like, you know, when your healer is healing like every turn, I think it feels a little bit weird. Like I don't really love that kind of a system. So yeah, so we try to stay away from that as well. So yeah, it came from mechanics, I would say the combination of the mechanics, wanting to fill those roles, and then also stay away from like traditional magic and sort of traditional fantasy stuff. Oh, we did have a dude with a sword. So we did have four classes originally when we were doing it. So the fourth class was called the Vanguard and had the sword that was like a... Oh, it was really cool. We were calling it like a whistle sword. It was like a sword that had a bunch of holes in it. It could like swing it over his head and it would make like different sounds, different noises. We kind of wanted him to be more like a buffer, like a buffer debuffer type class mixed with a melee character. But there was a little bit too much overlap, and when we talk about the hybrid class system, it really exploded the tree out. So when you marry two characters together, you end up with their children. If the parents are different classes, the children will be a hybrid class. And if you do the matrix, it actually depends. You get a different hybrid class. So say you... I'm explaining this super terribly. It's a podcast, though. I can ramble around, right? So if you retire a caberjack and you marry them to an alchemist, so it's a caberjack household and you marry an alchemist into it, you end up with a what's called a blast capper, which is like a caberjack that fights with some like alchemist explosive potions and stuff. But if you do it the other way around, you have an alchemist house and you marry a caberjack into that, you end up with a brutalist, which is an alchemist that has like more melee attacks and like more melee versatility. So it's like they sort of influence each other. So it's like the AB version of the hybrid class is different from the BA version of the hybrid class. So if you do the matrix, we have three core classes and then six hybrid classes. But if you blow it out to four core classes, you end up with 12 hybrids. And it really like, you know, just sort of, that was like a pure production issue. Not to mention the like balancing issues and all the other things that pop out of that, but just doing all of the animation, all the art and animation and sound effects and visual effects and all the stuff that goes into like doing a class, and then doubling the number of hybrid classes, it just didn't seem like it was going to be feasible. So we ended up cutting that one and just having the alchemist focus more on melee, so that we had two melee classes and one range class.
So it's a matter of kind of resources then?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's also like, I mean, just in terms of, you know, sometimes, like, just because you remove something doesn't mean it's, like, necessarily less than or worse. You know, like, at the end of the day, like, once we got the hybrid system in place, I don't think that I was really missing an additional class, because more is definitely not always better. But yeah, there were some cool ideas. Like, I was sort of bummed to see it go. But yeah, once we got near the road to finally in the game, it was like I felt a lot better about not having it.
You do have those hybrid classes, but I have a trick shot archer who can shoot like explosive rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very useful when you kill those tree things.
Yeah, the cradles explode, and then you've got like
God,
three sealed
those guys.
Yeah.
But the hybrid classes still have the same kind of look as the base classes. How do you respond to the to people who might say, "Well, that seems a little repetitive"?
Yeah, I mean, it's for sure that would be like that's like just a raw production issue, you know, just like having. That was sort of our way around it, is that we just modified their armor a little bit so that they would have, like in the case of the trick shot, they're going to be wearing like the hunter armor, but they'll have like some of the alchemist like explosive potions sort of hanging off of their armor and stuff. And that was, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's tough. It's tough, like doing six hybrids and having totally unique skeletons and models and everything and animations for them. It's just a little bit outside of our scope, so... Yeah, I wish that all of those could be, like, fully unique classes. You know, you see something like Final Fantasy Tactics, and each of those jobs has, like, totally unique art and unique unique abilities and all unique stuff. And that's, that would have been awesome.
How big is your team?
It was anywhere from, like, three, and then we were probably at peak maybe, like, 10 or 11. But it was not that big for long. You know, that was just like, I would say at the peak of production, when we were doing, we had like, yeah, when we were really cranking on the art, and yeah, that was probably like our full staff.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but your background, so the last game you made was, you worked on Iron Brigade.
Yep.
Which was a tower, kind of a 3D tower defense game.
Mm-hmm.
And then the game before that, were you working on Psychonauts?
Mm-hmm. Brutal Legend was before that, and then Psychonauts before that, yeah.
So puzzle games, platformers, some tower defense. So this kind of strategy RPG area is kind of new territory for you, even though it seems like you enjoyed that genre. What's it been like kind of transitioning into that as from the perspective of a designer?
It's cool. It's always cool to try new stuff. And I think that Tim is like really supportive of people at the studio that get like inspired by a particular thing. And for me, like, you know, that was primarily XCOM, but a lot of these other games were like super inspirational to me. It's super fun and challenging to take on a new thing, but it's also like, I wish that we had more experience at times, you know. It would definitely have to learn some hard lessons where, you know, like if we only made tactical RPGs and this was our fifth one, there's a lot of like knowledge that would be built up, you know. Even if we were to make another one now, like we've learned so much from making a bunch of mistakes on Massive Chalice that I think that it would go much smoother and we'd end up with like a better game in the end. So yeah, I think that it definitely costs you when you have to like go down a bunch of roads and you know you've never made that kind of game before and you don't know what you're doing. But yeah, we talked to some people that had done it before, like especially Jake Solomon, who was the lead on the new XCOM. Like I talked to him quite a bit and he, you know, he gave us a bunch of like advice about making that kind of game. And that certainly helped. Like, I think that helped us avoid some dead ends. But yeah, we were not mistake free on it for sure, because we just didn't have the experience. You know, it's like we're only really drawing on our experience playing those games and not making those games. So yeah, we definitely screwed up a decent amount as we went through it.
What were some of the hard lessons that you learned, if you don't mind sharing?
I think like underestimating the amount of UI design necessary to make the game function. And more importantly, I would say like tactical combat feedback. That was something that like I knew was important, but in terms of just like making absolutely sure that we're like putting the camera in the right place, and then we have really good sequence combat text where it's like, okay, the damage number is like red and it flies out the right of the character's HP flag, and then like his statuses are like, you know, like buffs are like fly out to the right and debuffs fly out to the left, and you know, and then the battle cry when a character gets a kill comes out like to the upper left, and it's like all sequenced very very like specifically. That was something that I was just like not prepared to spend as much time on as we did, you know. It just sort of seemed like I think that comes from working on action games, where a lot of that is just obfuscated and it's just based on feel. How much damage, like Iron Brigade is a great example, like just how much damage your weapons are doing and like what's happening and when things are dying and whatever. You just sort of rely on more like the visceral feel of playing the game in order to get that stuff across, and the sound effects and animation and all that stuff. But in a turn-based game, it's like you really want that like super, super explicit, like this is exactly what's happening. Like this character damaged this other character for this exact amount and then applied this debuff to it. It's like you want to know every little detail of that. So yeah, I think that was something that I kind of thought was going to be relatively simple, but we ended up spending like a ton of time on. And then, UI in general, I would say was tough. You know, there's just a ton of UI in the game, a lot of different screens. It took a lot of iteration to try to get that right. And I still don't, you know, there's always room for improvement, with things like that. I don't think that for the people that really want it, I don't think that we show enough like numbers and like exact, like, you know, what is the the old age buff, like how, or the, well, I guess it's a buff and a debuff, you know, the old age status. Like, what exactly is that doing to your character? You know, we just sort of tell you that it's like, oh, it's like decreased fertility and it's decreased sight range and it's increased intelligence, but by how much? It's like, we don't really, you know, you can't really drill into that. Part of that was just that we knew it was going to be a console game as well, and it's kind of tough to like explain all that stuff, like, and still keep it readable, keep the font size to a point where you can actually like read it and not clutter the shit out of the screen. But yeah, I haven't really seen people complain about that too much. But yeah, I think that's something that we would take a better stab at if we were to do it over again.
So Massive Chalice was in early access for quite a while.
Yeah.
What kind of feedback did you get that like made an impact on the game?
We kind of wanted to do the hybrid class system. It actually wasn't in place when we launched the game, and that was one of the biggest criticisms, was that it was like only three classes. You know, the people were, it didn't really matter. The class of the character that you married into the family didn't have any effect on like the children's skill tree or what kind of equipment they use and stuff. So I think that was a big improvement that addressed one of the like major concerns. Balancing was a huge issue too. Like I'm really glad that we went through early access, if only to like get the game in a better place balance wise. It was incredible to like put it into early access and then with Twitch just like immediately watch people stream the game and just like get this instant feedback from players was like totally insane. Like I was not really prepared for that, you know, just like how tight the feedback loop was there. And we could, you know, jump into the chat room and like talk to the people who are streaming and like get their opinions on the game, see sort of like what parts of the UI they're missing and they're not getting. You know, it was like one of the best focus tests we've ever had, because the person who's streaming is like rather than, you know, bringing in a focus tester and having them play the game like you know, in a lab or like in your office or whatever, a very like unnatural environment, you're actually like watching somebody play the game like in their natural environment, and it's super cool. And then you can ask them questions and they are like super excited that developers are there like you know, looking in on them and stuff. So that was really cool, like just to help us balance the game. I'm trying to think of other things that people... difficulty for sure. Like, I mean, I guess that's related to balance, but we launched with, like, a single difficulty mode, which I believe is, like, the one in the middle, which we ended up calling hard. And it was just much too hard for a lot of players. Like, that was one of the major criticisms. Like, we didn't have difficulty modes. I kind of wanted to get the first one right first before we added in a bunch of others, just so that we could make sure that all of the feedback that we were getting was about, you know, like this single difficulty mode, so that, you know, if you don't do that, then everybody who is giving you balanced feedback, you have to constantly ask them, like, you know, well, okay, well, were you playing it on the brutal difficulty? Were you playing it on normal? Like, what were you playing it on? And so, yeah, like adding that in was, I think, a big bonus. Yeah, I'm trying to think of other things that people really harped on. There were some things that, you know, we just couldn't do anything about because of scope reasons. And I think that, you know, like the number of enemy types, I would have loved to see that get expanded, but that was more of a production issue. Yeah, people just wanted more stuff, you know? They just wanted more classes, more enemies, more tech to unlock, more items to use, you know, just more... More. But I guess if that's the only complaint somebody has, is that they liked what's there, but they just wanted more of it, it's like, that's fine. Like, I feel like we did a good job. Yeah.
You'll forgive me. I recently wrote a fairly lengthy feature about early access, and it's fairly well known that Double Fine had some trouble in that regard recently.
Sure.
Did you find that... the fallout from that was impacting people's perception of Massive Chalice? Did you have to work harder to kind of regain their trust?
Yeah, that was tough. I mean, I think that there was a lot of negativity when we originally went into early access. It was tough. Like, I think one of the things I learned, which is a really unfortunate lesson, is that, you know, people are, once their mind's made up, it's like really hard to sway them. And a lot of people just aren't willing to have their mind changed, and they're not willing to even read what you write. That was rough, because like when we went into early access, that was like in October. We had like a reasonably complete game. I would say like 85 to 90% complete. Like, it was playable from start to finish. Like, all the major features were in place. It was reasonably balanced. I mean, there were some issues, but it was reasonably balanced. You could do a complete playthrough. And, you know, we very clearly stated, like, here are the things that we're going to add to the game, you know? And some of the things that we added were, like, above and beyond what we kind of initially stated. We were like, you know, we're going to translate the game. We're going to add the difficulty modes. We're going to put the iron mode in. We're going to, you know, like, here's the list of, like, it's like 5 or 7 things. You know, we're like, outside of this, like, we consider the game to be complete. And then we just, you know, set out to do those things, while also incorporating other feedback and doing even more than we said. But yeah, there were a bunch of people that just wanted to come and be dicks. Like, God, straight up, just people that just wanted to come and just like be dicks because of some other shit that had happened. And that was really unfortunate, especially for the, you know, for the team to work so hard on it. And like, Double Fine is pretty segregated, you know, like, nobody on my team worked on Space Base, and nobody on the Space Base team worked on my game. So it was like, it was really unfortunate to see the game get punished for, I think, what had happened on that other project. But yeah, I mean, it's like, at the same time, like, I kind of understand, and I see people's points. I do think that people get way too fired up about it, you know, is that it's like, yeah, it's like nobody got injured. You know what I mean? Like nothing really major happened. I don't know. It's like, I think people took it way too far, and they took it too seriously, and they said some really, really mean things. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I wish that could have gone a little bit differently. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's like, it's not under my control, you know, like that part is just totally outside my control. And we just tried to interact with and listen to the people that were just there to talk about the game. You know, it's like, just we tried always to steer the conversation back to the game and sort of point to like our goals and like our objectives in early access, and just sort of just try to be as positive as possible about it, you know, and just really, really try to like prove that we were going to do it correctly. What I believe is at least one correct way to use early access, which is just to, you know, get your game almost all the way complete, clearly list what you're going to do, and then give a time frame for when you're going to do it, and then just do it. You know, like, it was weird, like, all the, and given the state of the game when we went into early access, I was kind of shocked that people were, like, naysaying, you know, that people were, like, kind of, claiming that we wouldn't be able to do the things that we were about to do.
Well, people have been burned so much by early access.
Yeah, I guess so. It is a really weird, it is a weird thing. It's a weird.
And last year was a particularly bad year for it.
Yeah, that's true. There was like, was that game called Towns? Am I thinking of the right game?
Possibly.
There were some, yeah, there were a couple of people that just kind of ghosted out of early access, and that,
yeah.
Yeah, it's a bummer. I don't know. So
would you do it again?
Would I do it again? It's so weird, because I think the game is better because we did it, for sure. But would I want to go through like the sort of like mental brutalization that happened because of it? Like, no, absolutely not. Like, I would not want to do it because of that. You know, like, I don't, it's, yeah, that, wow, that's really hard. That's a hard trade-off for me, because I think that you do end up with something that's better, but at the expense of, like, mental health, and that really sucks. Like, I don't, yeah, because it's, like, it got to the point where I didn't really even want to go to the Steam forums. Like, I would just, like I made it a point to go there every day, but that was like one of the worst parts of my day because there would just be all this like negativity up there and it was all outside of my control and stuff. But I wanted to harvest the good parts about it, and there were lots of good parts about it. People posting their, you know, thoughts about their playthroughs, thoughts about the balance, suggestions. Would I do it again? I guess no. I would trust my gut, because also who knows what the game would have looked like if we had just done it internally during that part, you know? Would it have been better? I don't know. I feel like it would have been a little bit better if we did it, you know, the way that we did it. But I don't know that for sure. You know? I don't know. Yeah, I would prefer to not engage with that level of like toxicity if I could. So
when it comes to Massive Chalice itself, do you have additional content planned, kind of maybe an expansion pack, build out on some of the stuff that you had to cut because in the first round because of production constraints and that kind of thing?
We don't have anything planned right now, but we definitely have ideas like things that hit the cutting room floor. And I think it's like really ripe for a kind of like old school PC expansion pack, you know?
I completely agree.
Yeah, it's like, I think it's, you know, just the sort of like old like Blizzard and Firaxis kind of like expansion packs where it's like, you know, you want to play the whole game starting from the beginning, you know? Like, because I do feel like a lot of people that play Master Chalice, like they're going to have to restart the game at least once. Just because there's a pretty steep learning curve and you're going to probably make some bad decisions and then end up like with either like underleveled heroes or no heroes or whatever. So
Or heroes of all one class.
Yeah,
is what happened to me.
Oh, that did. Did you end up getting out of that?
It was all hunters.
Okay.
Well, my solution was just to go and do the research, find more heroes. Right. And then I would get a new baseline of like Caberjacks and alchemists. And cool. I still have a severe shortage of alchemists, mm-hmm. but I've got a lot more. I've got some Shadowjacks. I've got lots of Shadowjacks now, which is great.
That totally makes sense, right? Because you're probably going to be marrying those hunters into the Caberjack family. And then, you'll end up with Shadowjacks.
They're like cheetahs. You know, they all share the same genetic code.
That's cool. I don't know. That's what I would like to do is like a really beefy expansion pack, which kind of invites you to start the game over completely, even though you're very familiar with it. And, you know, like having like a fourth class and a couple more enemy types, some new tech, like a new environment, like, you know, just a little bit more of everything kind of put into the mix, I think would make the game significantly better. Also, it's like, it is a pretty procedural game. So when you just have more content to be randomly pulled, it's just like, it makes the entire experience less repetitive. And so, I think that would go a long way for the game, but it would be pretty expensive the way that I would want to do it. It would be pretty expensive. And that's a bummer, because I do think a lot of times people look for those like quick, I don't know what you want to call them, like quick fix DLC things, kind of like, you know, small little stuff that is like easy to produce and people will still pay for. But I just feel like if you're going to do it, you should just like do it for real. And I think the Iron Brigade expansion is very much like that. The, you know, like whole new environment, a bunch of new levels, new gear, new, you know, just like, you know, tons of new dialogue, like all that stuff. Like that's how I would want to do it if we were to do it.
Well, I will look forward to it. And you can look forward to my Massive Chalice review, which should be up by the time that this podcast goes up. So go check it out on usgamer.net. Brad Meir, where can we find you?
I'm on Twitter most of the time. I am like not really a social media person, or I wasn't. But yeah, I'm on Twitter like all the time. It's at Mr. Mooear. MrMooear. It's sort of like a dumb joke about my last name. Check me out there. And then you can shoot me an email, brad@doublefine.com. Don't spam me, please. but
too
that is,
late.
That is just
no,
like,
our audience is great.
That's
nice.
Just like my real email address. So like, feel free to send something over there. I'm pretty crappy. I think Twitter is better just because like I love that it's only 140 characters. Because I feel like sometimes when I'm like, hey, like you can send me an email, people have emailed me like they want advice or something, and they email like, you know, like a dissertation, like this novella, and I'm like, oh my god, like I barely have time to read this, let alone like dissect it and give you like a, you know, really well thought out response. So I think that Twitter is so good. Just I love that like limiting super short format. That's more than likely that's like the best way to get a hold of me. Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Brad, and good luck going forward.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me, Kat.
All right, so that's the end of our episode. So, Richard, where can I find you?
You can find me, of course, over on Kotaku.com or on Twitter at @biggestinjapan, because I am the one man alive arrogant enough to take the name.
The biggest in Japan.
Yep.
And can I find you on Twitter?
Or yeah, that is my Twitter.
Oh my god, like, you know, it's 8 in the morning. I'm a little like out of it. So,
yeah. We're having fun here. It's midnight for me, it's 8 in the morning for Kat, you know.
Exactly. So, and I'll see you a little later when I'm in Japan during the summer. So, that'll be exciting.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
And of course, you can find us over on usgamer.net. Go check out our YouTube channel, usgamer.net. Check out our Twitch channel, usgamer.net, where I'm doing a long play of Star Trek Judgment Rites, and it's awesome.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I haven't dropped by. What episode are you on?
I am about to embark on Voids. So the one where the Enterprise gets trapped in the nebula and gets disabled, and you have to wander around the Enterprise solving puzzles.
Ah, always a fun one.
And the one after that is Museum Heist. Or
that's
Museum
my
Piece.
Favorite. That's Museum the one Heist. Where you're Scotty for most of it.
Yes, yes.
That is my absolute favorite level in that game.
Isn't it Chekhov and Scotty?
Yeah, yeah.
Because
but
Chekhov wants
Chekhov.
To go down and get vodka. Because Russian stereotypes, everybody. So anyway, check out that. The first two parts are over on our YouTube channel, US GamerNet. And for Richard and for Brad Meir and for myself, thanks for dropping by. We'll be back next week to talk about the 20th anniversary of Earthbound with Bob Mackey, who's making his long-awaited return to the show. And until then, happy adventuring. We'll be right back.